be intentional about your career. And beyond that is, you know, find somebody to mentor you. I would tell them, you know, get into something where they can and be coachable. So I think those are the three things. You know, I was intentional pretty early on in my career. I had mentors, but I didn't realize who they were, and I learned how to be coachable late. So I would tell you to do all those things. And I would tell you the last thing is really get engaged in the community.
What's up, everybody? My name's Drew, and you're listening to the Circle City Success Podcast. This is the podcast for indie young professionals where my co-host Jared and I interview successful people in the Indianapolis area and share their knowledge and experience with indie young professional community. You're listening to episode 81 with Dick Aderman. Dick's a former business leader and CEO known for leadership and turning around businesses. Currently, he's the president of the iTeam, where he uses his knowledge and experience to help facilitate conversations between CEOs to provide them with a confidential space to share and get feedback on important issues and problems with their peers. In this episode, you'll hear Dick tell us about how taking the margins of a $200 million product line from single digits to the teens that he was responsible for at 27 years old set the trajectory for his career, about continuously turning around struggling businesses throughout his career and how he was able to consistently do so, and why two of the greatest lessons that he's learned along the way are to be coachable and to build a great team. But before we get to the episode, I want to tell you really quickly about our partnership with Synergize. Synergize is a catalyst for creating personal relationships between business leaders. They create successful long-term relationships by aligning professionals by the legacy they aspire to create rather than the next transaction. If you're interested in developing more intentional and deeper relationships than you do through traditional networking, and you want to learn more about Synergize, then check out SynergizeIndy.com. Here's Circle City Success Episode 81 with our guest, Dick Aderman.
Dick, your LinkedIn profile says lead with your edge. What's your edge?
Oh, well, I'm known for leadership. I think, and I'm known for turnarounds. I think the other big edge that's mine is I strongly believe in teams and teamwork. I like winning. So winning's an important part of my edge. And throughout my career, I've enjoyed innovating. I think that's a really important part of my edge. And then probably maybe one of the last things that I've kind of encouraged wherever I've worked is learning. So lifelong learning is really important. And I try to practice that all the time.
So I think that asking this question will probably lead into more getting in depth behind those things. But how does a guy with degree in communications get into kind of like the biomedical field?
Well, I have two degrees. So I have a degree in business, an undergraduate in business, and I stuck around and got a degree in speech communication. So it was intentional on my part. I got into business starting off in school, and then really enjoyed the communications piece of it. Really spent a lot of time thinking about human motivation, and then of course getting a lot of opportunity to do public speaking. So those two things I think worked hand in hand in business. How did I get into healthcare? I was introduced to the number one HR guy at a big company back in the right after I got out of college. There were three companies that most people wanted to work for at that time: Procter & Gamble, IBM, and American Hospital Supply. And I got introduced through a friend to the top HR guy and managed to get an interview with him. And it was in Evanston. And he sent me to three divisions, and I got three job offers out of that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Healthcare is pretty cool.
So I know when we've spoken before, mm-hmm. You told me that your dad was a pretty big inspiration to you, and you kind of told me the story about that. Can you tell us that?
Yeah. So my dad, he only had a high school degree. He went into the military in 1942. So right after Pearl Harbor was bombed, and he was in his early 20s. So he ended up doing the most with his talent and his knowledge of anybody I think I know. you know, I could tell you all sorts of stuff about him, but you know, the short story is by the time 1960s rolled around, he accepted a job as a manufacturer's representative selling. He had this really kind of huge personality, and he sold nuts and bolts, which is the ultimate commodity. And he knew his product line very, very well because he'd worked on a farm as a young boy and as a in construction as a young man. And then in the well, it was called the Army Air Corps at the time. So he was a supply in the supply chain there and supplied parts for the Air Force. And actually spent some time on Saipan and Okinawa. So here's this guy, not much education, and he ran this business, and he took it from 300,000 to 10 million. And 10 million was 10 million in the 70s and 80s. That was a lot of money. Still a lot of money now, but it was a lot then. And through sheer product knowledge and personality, and I learned a lot of things along the way about him. He had a brand, which I think is really important. And he had his edge. You know, the brand was, he was called the Brownie Man, but his edge was he was really great at customer service and very knowledgeable about his products. And he was willing to help any of his customers. Typically people who buy nuts and bolts are coming right out of college and it's their first job. So he would sit down, he'd offer to sit down with them for 3 to 4 or 5 days and teach them about buying nuts and bolts and things like that. They often took him up on it. And of course, you know, whenever anybody had a question, he was the guy that got the call. So he was a Brownie Man because he was trying to distinguish himself from others. And he eventually got around to this idea. There were these brownies that were made in my hometown of Wheaton, and they were amazing brownies. And he would bring them in Tupperware boxes to all of his accounts. So like John Deere, International Harvester, Caterpillar, you know, all these huge places. And when he'd get there, the receptionist would call and tell everybody the Brownie Man's here, come get your brownies. So he would, so when he called, you know, like when he wasn't visiting, he was calling somebody, call and ask for him. People would say, oh, he's not here. And my dad's, well, tell him the Brownie Man called. Oh, wait, you know, I could go get him. He's right. You know, he's in a meeting. I'll get him out. You know, so he just had this way of endearing himself to people. And he was an amazing guy.
Was he covering multiple states?
Yes, he did. I you know, it was like Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, you know, the Dakotas. So he traveled a lot. We traveled with him. It was one of the cool things that we got to do. We would in the summers when he wasn't around, the office was in our basement. So when the phone rang, you know, we would take calls. We would talk to customers. You know, I was like, I don't know, probably 10, 11, 12 years old. We were talking to customers. They would inquire about pricing, and then we would call his suppliers and get the pricing, and then we would call the customers back. So we were doing customer service when we were kids. And then every summer he would take my brother and I at least for a week, and we'd go travel with him. So we'd get to, in smaller customers, we'd get to sit in and watch him sell. So imagine that when you're 9, 10, 11 years old. And then the other cool thing was that some of the bigger places where we wouldn't necessarily sit with him with the purchasing people, they would arrange for a tour of their factories. So we saw how combines were made, and tractors, and front end loaders, and all sorts of cool stuff, motorcycles. So it was very cool. That's a great education when you're that young. We got a lot of windshield time as kids with him. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. It sounds like you had a ton of like major takeaways from, you know, working with being his customer service guy, watching him doing sales, the branding. What was kind of like your number one takeaway that even maybe at moments now in your life, you kind of think back to the time you're with your dad then?
Don't mess up. Every sale is important. And so, you know, you want to make sure you got, you know, nuts and bolts. It was like they'd order stuff. Oh, it's okay. I need something 1 1/4 inch by 1 1/4. And you'd like repeat it and write it down and make sure you had it. And I need 10,000 pieces of that. You'd write it down. so you just want to make sure that you knew what was what they were doing, and you knew, you know, you made sure that you communicated back with the suppliers who were supplying it. You know, I that's one of the things. I think the other big thing is just relationships. How important, and this is why, of course, what our friend Aaron Stanton is doing with, you know, relationships over everything. I mean, for my dad, it was all about relationships. You know, even thinking back to the 80s and 90s, everybody's like, well, you know, we need to get more sophisticated about business. It's about, you know, knowing products and all. But at the end of the day, I think it's all about relationships, and that never really changes. So I think that's probably the one thing that really sticks with me. Two things: don't mess up, and relationships are important, and take care of your customer.
So you said, kind of coming straight out of college, you got a job at one of those big three companies.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Oh, it was terrific. American Hospital Supply. I'm not sure they make companies like that anymore. We made some of our own products, but we distributed a lot of products. And I think the most amazing thing about American was how much responsibility you would get at a young age. I learned a lot. We had multiple product lines that we sold. I moved up through the organization, I think, through marketing. I was telling somebody the other day, I think by the age of 27, I was responsible for a $200 million product line. And, you know, friends of mine had gone out to regions and had responsibility for, you know, 40, 50, $60 million sales regions and, you know, full distribution, P&L. And it just I don't think companies do much of that today. So it was huge learning ground. There was no training at the time, believe it or not. I mean, there was no sales training. We used to laugh. Here's your map. Here's the catalog. Go travel with a couple of guys and then come back in a week and tell me how it's going. That's kind of it. So there was a lot of sink or swim, and it was very competitive environment. You know, men and women from best schools all around and very sharp people. And so it was a great experience. But we got a ton of responsibility early in our career. So it was a great learning ground.
You mentioned that it was a kind of a competitive environment with the people that you're working with. What do you think you did to try to help set yourself apart and kind of help climb the ranks?
You know, I, at the end of the day, I was really just focused on doing a really good job. I had a lot of that. So that $200 million product line was the lowest tech products in the company. So the high tech products were all it was a real push at the time. And so my job was to take these low growth, low profit products and turn them into something that people actually wanted to spend time selling. We came up with a strategy with my boss, who's my first mentor. We came up with a strategy to private label things. So we consolidated product lines. We negotiated with the best suppliers. We negotiated exclusives. We got better margins, higher quality products. And we turned our product line was probably declining. You know, if not flat, it was probably declining. And the margins were in single digits. A couple of years after we got control of it, we were in the upper teens in terms of growth and the low 30s in terms of margins. And that made, and the way that we aided the sales reps in the sale made the sale very easy. A lot of 800, at that time, 800 numbers with people that could complete the sale, answer customer questions, things like that, all provided by the suppliers themselves.
Was that kind of like the first experience of turning something around?
Yes and no. So my first experience of turning something around is, I go back to my dad. My dad, we bought a house, an old house, and had to modernize it. It had been built in probably the 1915 era or something like that. We bought it in the 1960s. And so we remodeled it. So that was my first experience with remodeling or turning something around. Yes, that product line was the first product line that I turned around. But at the same time I was doing that, I had bought two homes actually during that time span, both homes on the North Shore of Chicago, and both homes that I rehabbed to different degrees. One was just really to modernize it. The other was totally gut it. And it was very lucrative. So, but, you know, rehabbing a house is kind of the same as rehabbing a business. There are certain key things that you look for that you're going to invest in. And, you want to make sure your investment works. Location, 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 all those kind of things work as well. And, so a lot of similarities.
And then, so you kind of fast forward a little bit. We know that you helped turn a division around at Roche.
Yes.
How did you get to the position of kind of leading that charge?
Well, I'd been recruited down here by the then CEO, a guy named Denny Ware. And Denny was my second mentor in my career. And I had joined just prior to what was BMC being acquired by Roche. And so there was a lot of upheaval. And coming out of that, he gave me a position. He had told me point blank that they wanted me to be his, to replace him someday. So I thought, oh, wow, somebody wants me to be a CEO. That's great. That's what I wanted to be. So it looks like it's working. He put me, after the dust settled after the acquisition, there was a position running corporate accounts, and he wanted to invest in it and grow it and have it be the growth engine of the business. And we were very fortunate to put together a great team. I think we really read the markets right. And we did. We drove the growth of the business, drove a lot of market share into the business, had a lot of success. And a lot of people contributed to that. And one of the divisions was struggling and not making money, and it was a good sized business. And so they decided to make a switch and put me into it. And it was one of those things in your career where those kind of opportunities that come along once in a lifetime. So yeah.
You mentioned building a good team. What were you looking for in the individuals that you were kind of recruiting for that team?
Another great question. It all started really with the strategy that we put together, and I can still recall the strategy. I can go through it. our job was to improve the profitability of the business. The guys over in Mannheim, Germany, and Basel, Switzerland want us to grow it, but they want us to be profitable. So we really took a hard look at the way we're marketing the products and all that. I wanted really energetic people who'd had a lot of success. I wanted really customer-oriented people working for us. I was very, and still am, I'm a real process guy, a real process-driven person. So much of what was holding the company back were really poor processes. It was a real misery index looking at all our KPIs. And so we had to go through one by one and work on them. So we did a lot of process engineering through Six Sigma. We had a whole group that did that. But we listened to the customers, we listened to the employees to tell us what should be done in what order. We did some innovation, which I think is really important. And then, I think the other thing that we did is we promoted, I thought, really good people. So when we were looking for people to be in those positions, we wanted people that were process oriented, that were results oriented, customer oriented, and were working to develop their people.
So when you kind of got taken away from the business that's doing really well and put into the one that's struggling, were you reluctant at all, or did you kind of see it more as an opportunity?
I jumped right into it. It was a great move. A guy named Martin Madaus put me in the job. Martin was replaced Denny as CEO. Martin was a great guy to work with. I just saw it as really a great opportunity in my career. And it was really a blast. There were times where it was pretty daunting, but just we had so much success in turning different elements around quickly, and people could see that things were working, and it just kind of picked up speed. So we had great growth.
How did you decide like what the process should be for turning that business around?
Well, I always start with people. And, you know, so you have to get the right people on the team. And this is going to sound a lot like Patrick Lencioni, and that's okay, but this is how it works. He was right. So you definitely want the right team leading this. So, and unfortunately that means sometimes you have to move people off of it. So we want everybody pulling the same direction. I think we had that with this team. I think the second thing was I'd thought about the strategies. Some of them just came to me through different reading that I had done, and, you know, our team agreed that that was the way to go. So that was very helpful. I think the next thing after that is everybody on the team did a great job of communicating what we were trying to accomplish and how we were trying to accomplish it. And that made, you know, and we were able to get people's training like Six Sigma. We had special sales training for people to work their way up into the C-suite. And people took to that very readily. So, so we had great success with, you know, communicating what we were doing, and people got it. We did a lot of communication, and then we supported it through the systems that we put behind it. So
I know just from looking at your LinkedIn profile that Six Sigma and Agile are kind of seem like two main things that really have helped you turn around businesses.
Yes.
When did you learn about this and then start implementing it and then figure out that it's working and it's, you know, kind of a key for you?
Yeah. And so when I went into the position running this business unit at Roche, Martin said to me, he said, you know, Quest Diagnostics is doing the Six Sigma thing. I should do it in somewhat of a German accent if I really want to sound like but he's like, you know, you got to go find out what they're doing. Said, oh, great. So I went out and visited a couple of people at Quest, and they said, hey, read a couple of books. I think you're going to like it. I had a woman who had worked for me in corporate accounts who was terrific and very process-oriented and a real taskmaster. And so we put her in charge of Six Sigma, and, you know, we ran with it. And it transformed our business, quite frankly. After I left Roche, I went to work. You know, one of the places I went to work was a place called QuadraSpec up in West Lafayette. It was a diagnostics tool that came out of some technology there from a guy named Fred Renier, who ran the chemistry department, and David Nolte, who ran the physics department. And we were looking for a way to kind of speed the development of this. And one of the other incubator companies were up there, had been a software company, had been working with Agile. And we, you know, almost from the get-go, it just struck me as the right thing. These are for complex situations, complex development situations. You know, with a diagnostic system, there's software, there's hardware, there's chemistry involved, and it doesn't get more complex than that. And so we used it as a way to speed development. And then I used it again at HiCor, both at HiCor, to improve processes, speed development of the new system there.
I guess high level, can you just give us an overview of kind of what the ideas are behind these two concepts?
So Six Sigma is really a methodology and toolkit that really helps take processes and make them as efficient, as effective as possible, and a way for you to really look hard at them and monitor them. So I'm trying to, you know, some of the things, you know, so like at Roche, for an example, we had 5 million in service rep overtime, and there were a lot of things factoring into it. One of the big things was we were placing a lot of equipment, but parts and materials were not showing up when the service reps got there. So consequently, a service rep would get there, they'd start to do their work, and then they go, oops, this part's missing. I have to order it. I'll be back, you know, tomorrow or in 2 days or something. I mean, you know, first it's a waste of time. Well, first it's, you know, customer gets upset. Second, it's a waste of time, right? Now you've got somebody making a return trip and all the costs that go with it. So through that process and other things, we brought a new guy, Raymond Young Jr., in to come and run the service group. He did a terrific job. But we brought people in like that and put these processes into place. It took that $5 million and cut it down to under $1 million in overtime.
Yeah.
So that's just an example. I'll never forget my controller was like, you know, when I said, we got to cut 13 people out of the organization to do this. She goes, we can't afford to do that. You know, we're already losing money. Said, we can't afford not to do it. We're losing money. So she fought me a little bit. Lisa Green, she would tell you she fought me a little bit. And then 3 years later, she was like the biggest champion of it. She went in front of the entire kind of board for Martin's leadership team and said, we documented $43 million in savings. And here's all the stuff that we did. And, you know, it was real. It worked. So, yeah.
So after kind of leading that turnaround at Roche, you know, then you had some other stints after that, kind of leading companies. Was that something like just you kind of felt like you've done your job at Roche and was ready to go on to more CEO type roles, or what was the transition like from Roche to?
It was really a combination of a number of things. I was in my 40s. So what year was this? 2005. So I was almost. Well, I was almost 50, and I was thinking, you know, my dad had already been in business by himself or as an entrepreneur, you know, in his early 40s, and I thought, man, if I'm ever going to do it, I mean, I better hurry up. And I was really passionate about information in healthcare, and there was a physician here in town that was doing something. There was a series of events that pushed me in that direction. And, I was thinking that I wasn't sure what my next job at Roche would be. And I wanted to be, thought being an entrepreneur would be great. So I did that. I learned a lot from it. It was a great product. And then, you know, series of events happened. I moved on to the next one. And that was really a Quadraspec where we spent a lot of time. We were on Wall Street October 2008, negotiating an agreement with that. Everything fell apart that day. Literally, we walked out, you know, and Wall Street was just a mess. It was weird to be there. Anyway, so, and, you know, this was an opportunity for me to start leading, you know, complete business. And not that Roche wasn't, but it was mainly the commercial aspect of it. I had a great partner there, a guy named Kent Koss, that ran operations for us locally. But, you know, we didn't have all the say in what products would be developed and those kinds of things. And you know, that's just how the company works. So I thought it'd be a great experience to get out and do some of that. And that's what I did. And that's what I've been doing since.
Mm-hmm. What were some of like the differences or things that you learned going from leading a business unit to leading a whole business?
Great question. You know, I don't think the leadership of it changes. If you have a vision for the business, that doesn't change. I learned a lot about, you know, product development and about manufacturing. We've been certainly in healthcare, you're always exposed to regulatory, but, you know, you take on even more of a role in regulatory when you start manufacturing and developing product. Very strict guidelines, stringent guidelines around that, compliance required. To me, it was just kind of a logical extension to what I had been doing. It was taking those pieces and having them integrate with the commercial end of it.
A couple times you've mentioned a mentor. You had one at American Hospital Supply, and then you mentioned Denny at Roche. How have mentors impacted you kind of throughout your career?
Yeah, each is different. And I had one more guy named Rich. And Rich was fantastic. He was my last mentor. He was a chairman of the board at HICOR. And we stayed in touch even over the years. The first mentor, Bill, really took me under his wing and helped me understand how things work in business. As a matter of fact, he just called me yesterday for my birthday. And we stay in touch once a year. He pulled me aside and, you know, really kind of walked me through how things work, and he was great. We went out, we did a lot together, negotiated contracts. He's a fabulous negotiator. And he's a smart guy. Like I said, a little rough and gruff, but I loved working for him. I worked for him for 7 years, so he was great. Denny was interesting because he got me to think much more in a CEO mindset. Denny, likewise, was rough and gruff. You know, we had more than one tough conversation. But, you know, Denny taught me how to look at the business, how to look at and not really how to, you know, manage your way through kind of corporate, you know, corporate motivation, let's put it that way. You know, how to work within a corporate structure. He was very good at it. And he and his wife also took Jenny and I, my wife, under their wing and said, you know, one of the most important things you need to do is you need to be visible in the community and do things. So we got engaged in a number of different charities at the time. We would show up at, you know, charity functions, fundraisers and things like that. And it was neat to meet the people in the city. So, he was good for that and more, obviously. And then Rich was awesome. Rich taught me to be coachable. Rich Novak taught me to be coachable. Something I tell everybody who's early in their age, learn to be coachable. I watch a lot of sports, you know, and you hear about, you know, is a guy coachable or not, or gal coachable or not. You know, I kind of had this thing where I need to be perfect in everything that I did. So sometimes I didn't take coaching very well. And Rich Novak was a guy who really was able to take me aside and provide some great coaching for me and really learn how to be a CEO.
What do you think that he said to you that kind of helped you make that transition of being coachable?
You have to know the guy to know, but he said, nobody wants to hear your tale of woe. He's just like, we just want to know that you understand what's going on in the business, that you have a plan to attack it, and that, you know, that plan is well thought out. He was very good about calling. And, you know, I worked at the time, it was a private equity firm. And, you know, private equity has a reputation. Some of it's deserved, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's about creating value, right? Mm-hmm. And so you got to put all your kind of personal feelings aside, which is what Rich was telling me. Nobody wants to hear your tale of woe. Put some of your personal feelings aside and, you know, get with it. Let's create value. And it was quite galvanizing, but Rich has been a great mentor.
So that was, you said HiCor, right?
Yeah.
And that company is headquartered in California.
Yes.
Were you in California or were you working out of Indianapolis?
So for the first year and a half, I had an apartment out there, and I was there for 2 weeks or 3 weeks on, and then I'd come home for a week or two, come back here. We have two daughters. They're in high school at the time, and, you know, I really, really did not want to move them. My family had moved when I was quite young and had an impact, I think, on the rest of my family. Not so much on me because I was so little when we moved. So I did not want to move our girls out, especially during high school. So I took an apartment there for about a year and a half, 2 years when we first started. And then we all agreed that I could start commuting. So it was kind of like go out there for a week, come back, go out for a week, come back. So started doing a little bit more from the home office. It was probably still about 65-70% travel. And then in the last 2 years there, I was there full time, and my wife was there. Girls had graduated from high school, from college, and my wife and I were out there. Loved it.
I was gonna say, what was some of the things you like that you like doing out in California that maybe they weren't even business related, just kind of getting learning the culture?
Yeah, there were a lot of neat things. I mean, the first thing was I had this great apartment, and it was down, it was in Newport Beach, and every morning when I drove out in the winter, I could look in my rearview mirror and see the ocean and look up and see mountains with snow on them. So that was that's not something you can do in Indiana.
Nope.
so that was pretty cool. we had a view of this island called Balboa Island. If you ever get a chance to look it up, it's this tiny little enclave, this bubble, very cool. And I used to go out every morning, just about every morning, and walk it before I go to work. And we would go down there on weekends and do stuff. And, you know, I think what was fun for us was just moving to an entirely different place. We, in the first 10 years of our marriage, we'd moved 5 times. And then we moved here 23 years ago. And so it was really fun to go to a different place and meet people and get to know them and get them to know us by first name, you know, in Laguna Beach and, you know, Corona Del Mar and Newport Beach and, areas in Orange County. It was a really great experience. It's a different way to live. There's a lot of really cool stuff out there. I think we definitely like Indiana. yeah. But yes, it was a lot of fun, and it's a totally different culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now today, kind of taking all this experience that we talked about and the things that you've learned from your mentors, you're kind of turning that around and using that and helping people, kind of acting like their mentors, right?
Yeah, in a way. And it's, I really love this. And I thought about it for a while coming out. I thought I was looking at buying a business and then looking at coaching. And what I'm doing with Thaddeus is not so much coaching, as we really facilitate these great conversations between CEOs. And I don't know, you'd asked me a question before, you know, how do you measure success? And I actually was talking to my brother or my son-in-law that day, and he asked me kind of the same question. I said, well, it's different when I was in school, grade school, high school, college, it was, you know, how am I doing in sports and how am I doing in, you know, grades. And then after that it was, you know, how am I doing in income and, you know, what jobs am I attaining? So you certainly go through that. And I'm at the stage of my life now where, measuring success is by the relationships that I have. And I think what I can do to help others, and it's why I really like this. We just had a group today, our first, we've got five groups or so now. And one of them began today, and it was really fun to be in there and see the group interact with each other, see each other giving, help and advice. And at the same time, allowing me to use some of my expertise and experience to make recommendations or ask questions or things like that. And, in my career, another question you'd asked me earlier is, what are you most proud of? I'm proud of a lot of things. One of the things is I have, I think it's over 20 people who've reported to me, or CEOs or presidents or managing directors of their business. And so that is, I like that opportunity to really work with and help people to improve their businesses. It's exciting.
So Thaddeus had already had the iTeam set up and running, why do you think he hired you out of anybody else that he could have chosen to work with him?
That's a great question. We went through quite a vetting process. We met through Aaron Stanton last year. And I think Thaddeus and I had lunch for the first time over at Basbo's probably in June or July. And I personally like the philosophy he works with, the idea of lead with your edge. And I think he came to see how important that really is to me. And that, and I think he's gotten a chance to get to know me and see my personality and how I work with people. And, all those things, he's built a really good business. The last thing you do is want to spoil that brand by bringing in the wrong person. I think he's brought in the right person. I think he does too. I think he made it up based on those things. And I think those are all the right reasons to make a decision on bringing people in. Is how do they help you keep the brand of your business? How do they help you keep that culture? And how do you work together?
So you mentioned there's about 5 groups that you kind of help facilitate the conversation. What, how many are in those groups? How many
we go up to 12 in the different groups. So we start off with a certain number and then we build them. So I think three of them are pretty well built. Two, like I said, kind of just gotten started, but there's a good populace already in those. So we do a number of different things to go out and prospect, like everybody, cold calls, networking. We've been doing something lately in Zoom meetings that I think has been successful. And you know, once we start building the teams, and we look pretty hard about who goes into those teams, we try to operate in a vertical. It's an industry vertical, or there's a characteristic of the businesses that they share in that vertical. So I think those are really a couple of stark differences in maybe other kind of coaching businesses. So so that's what we do.
And how are they structured? Is it like you guys have this specific curriculum that you're taking them through and saying, hey, we're starting here, we're going to, do this lesson or whatever you want to call it? Or is it more kind of like an open-ended type of thing?
It's really a facilitation. I mean, the thing that we work on is the most important issue of the day for each one of these CEOs. And we're not necessarily looking for CEOs that are working on their leadership. We're looking for CEOs that are working at growing their businesses and, have an idea of how they want to get there, but could use some help along the way from other peers. So I say this all the time when I talk to people. I think the CEO position, you say, wow, I want to be a CEO. What a great job. And when you get there, you realize it's quite a lonely job. There's a lot of decisions that fall on your shoulders. A lot of things that you don't really want to take home, because you don't want to scare anybody at home. You want to communicate with your employees, but there are some things that you just don't want to communicate to your employees because, again, you don't want to scare them because things go on all the time. Your leadership team generally knows what's going on, but they're giving you all the information, but they're certainly asking you to make the decision at the end of the day. And if you have a board, like I said, Rich is no tails or woe. We just want to know that you've identified the problem and options to work on it and are following through on it. So, I always say to people, it's a very lonely position. So these our network of CEO think tanks are really a great way for men and women to get into these meetings and speak to each other about what's going on in their business. And then Thaddeus, through what he's developed, has a method to facilitate and curate those discussions.
Yeah, it's almost like you can share things with other people that, like you just said, you can't share with just everybody. It's kind of like a safe place to share your thoughts and get solid feedback from this awesome peer group.
Yep, exactly. And typically they, because of what's going on in their business or their marketplace, they know what's going on in yours. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, they've been there. They'll have some ideas. It's also a place for somebody to throw out, hey, I'm thinking about these options. What do you think? And you get feedback on it. So it's not unstructured, but it's not, what you would think of some meetings where they have a guest speaker every month or other meetings where, we've written all the books. And, so this week we're working through, this month, this quarter, we're working through these books. Everybody's going through this. It's much different than that. So.
You get to be.
I think it's a very sophisticated approach to this kind of marketplace.
You get to be in rooms or maybe Zoom meetings with a bunch of really smart people. What kinds of things have you learned from this job so far? From getting to listen to those people, kind of go back and forth and share ideas and recommendations.
That's a great question. Each one of these groups is different. The people who are doing things are doing different things. So you're, for me, I'm constantly learning about new markets that I haven't been engaged with. So, 40 years of my career, I was in healthcare and healthcare only. And there are some things that are transferable to these other markets, but there's others that are, really different. And so they're, I think the thing that you learn is that their set of issues that they deal with could be quite different from one, industry vertical to the next, whether it's, from tech and SaaS and how you grow and, build and, you know, scale and those things to, you know, building the trades, which, you know, how do you get people to come in and do these things? You know, where's your resources? How do you train, create growth? You know, growth businesses, what they do, what they have to go through. So it's just, it's a really, you know, for me, I think the thing that is the most fun, it's what I liked as a CEO is, the job changed every hour because every hour was a new meeting. And that meeting was, you know, HR, and then it was, you know, R&D, and then we're going to do something in sales, and then, you know, maybe we've got a regulatory meeting. So I always needed that pace to hold my interest. And, you know, this is no different. This is learning about all these new markets, and, you know, it's fascinating. So it's a lot of fun. So I'm learning that, I think. I think one of the coolest things is to see how many people share with each other. That's also kind of a prerequisite of bringing people on. But they're very giving in these meetings. And so I think that's, I wondered how all that was going to work. And I think it's been great.
And when you're saying that, so you're kind of like talking about the groups have the same vertical or whatever. So it could potentially be competitors sharing with each other, right?
Well, we in these verticals, we don't have competitors.
Okay.
And if we do, they each know that they're going to be in it. But no, we typically don't have competitors in it. But, you know, they're, you know, often doing the same things, not product-wise, but growth-wise.
Do you think it's more difficult or less difficult to be kind of in their role now versus, let's just say, way back when you were kind of entering in kind of your CEO type roles? Would you rather have done it back then or now, or is it just completely different and hard to compare?
I don't have any choice. So I did it when I did it. I don't know that it's any easier or any worse or any tougher. You know, some of the problems that they face are the same problems I've faced in my career. So
yeah.
When I hear things, I it's a little bit of been there, done that. Despite the fact that I've been in healthcare the entire time, I think one of the strengths of my experience is from a family business to corporate to venture back to private equity. And so that gives me a lot of experience, a lot of different language that's used in each one of those that are different. And, how do I use, rely on that experience to provide input for people. So I don't think that there's really that much that's changed for them. Certainly the pandemic is something new, but that's new for everybody.
Yeah.
I think they're generally, I think people are dealing with things the same way today.
Is there like one, I don't know, a better word to say than issue that you think of that, you know, a bunch of CEOs have that you would have kind of say, hey, if there was one piece of advice that I could give to every CEO, here's what you should do.
Have a great team. I mean, really, it really does start off with team. You know, so many of the issues that people deal with are really organizational issues. I'm a small business. I'm growing. Who do I bring onto my team? How do I afford it? I've got somebody on my team that I think is kind of, as we've grown, that, you know, I've grown past them. What do I do? So at the end of the day, the job of the CEO is get things accomplished through other people, and get them accomplished, not in the way that they would do it, but to get the things that they would do accomplished. Right. So it's this idea that that people are so engaged that they will take up the banner and run with it, and make your job easier as a leader.
I think that was an interesting way of saying that the job of a CEO is to get things accomplished through other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. Otherwise, you're a one-man show for a long time, or a one-woman show for a long time. Your scores on Indeed and that won't be very high.
Throughout your career, did you have any habits or routines that kind of just help you stay on track on a daily basis?
So I every year I start off with writing out my own goals for business and for personal goals, things that, you know, that are important. And I routinely go back to those. Every week I sit down on Sunday, usually on Sunday nights, and write out my schedule for the week and all my tasks for the week and things that I have to do. And so I do those. And then every morning I get up. I'm an early riser. I tend to get up around 5:30 or 5:45 this morning, 4:45. And I get into my, you know, I have a regular routine of kind of reading news and current events and things like that. Get on a little social media and see what's happening. And then I typically do email and things like that early in the morning, kind of get those, get my day started like that. So, and then I, you know, and then at the end of the day, whether that's 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or 6:30 or seven, I turn it off.
Turn it off 100%.
Yeah, pretty much. I will sometimes studies and I will go back and forth, you know, a little message will pop up on my phone. It's like, oh, I better go answer that. but generally, I pretty much shut it off.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. I kind of shut it off on the weekends. I mean, Thaddeus and I both kind of work on Saturdays, but I'm a big believer in really getting separation from the business. You need your downtime, mm-hmm. I think, to be really effective in decision-making. I often tell people, you know, when you are in the toughest time, people say, oh, I can't go on vacation. I say, oh, that's exactly the time to go on vacation. Go get away from it. You know, take a few days and go get away from it. You'll be much more objective about what you're going through, and you know, the answers will come to you.
Mm-hmm. What about like the way that employees may see that, though?
See what?
Like if you were a CEO and you know you were going through a tough time, and then you got away, and you know, I feel like just. My initial thought when you said that, you know, employees might see that as, I don't know, being bad.
Well, it depends on how tough the time is. If the business is, you know, like days away from going out of business, yeah, that would really be a bad idea. But I'm talking about, you know, if you've got a tough decision to make, maybe there's a personnel decision that you have to make, or, you know, something like that. Maybe a shift in strategy or something that's is a big deal. It may not be as visible to the employees. Yeah, you don't want to see, you don't want your employees to see you walking out the door with, yeah, I'll be back when the fire's out. That's not how it works.
Keep me posted.
Keep me posted. Anybody call the fire department? Let me know. Yeah, no. But I think it's really important to get away from what you do and get some perspective. When you get so buried in it, you know, and people can get so anxious over it, you can do yourself a disservice. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep. What do you think young professionals in the Indianapolis area should be doing now to kind of take advantage of the things that are offered out there today?
Well, you know, I think I got in as I recognized probably later in my career how good the mentors I had were. So I would seek out mentors. I would be coachable. I wasn't very coachable early in my career. I would probably do that earlier. I'd really look to network just for myself. And I know I saw other guys who just get so focused on that next job and or doing what you're doing that you kind of block some of those things out. So I think networking is a very valuable thing, especially if you're going to stay in a city for a while. And we made a conscious decision in 2005 when I left Roche to stay in the city. So I think it's important to be networked into that. And I think the other thing I'd tell people is be intentional about your career. I sat down in 1991. I was in a job that I didn't like for, I was with Baxter, and I was working for a guy who, it was not a good mesh. And I thought, boy, what do I want to do? And I really said, I want to be a CEO. And I thought about the gap between my experience and expertise at that time and what I need to do. And I really went after it. And so I would tell people, be very intentional about your career. You know, whatever it is you want to do, really understand what that is and be intentional about it. I have a really good friend of mine that's he's been very intentional about his entire life. So,
yeah, I really like that. Yeah, because I think a lot of young professionals get caught up in getting into the right career, and then they kind of maybe they have some sort of a path that they've kind of envisioned, but sometimes that path doesn't necessarily lead to where you thought it was going to, or maybe you don't, after you see it at once you get in, you don't maybe not like it, and then just step back and say, okay, what do I want to do? Kind of like what you did, step back and say, okay, I want to be a CEO. What gap do I need to fill from that point to where I am now, and be intentional in the action? So I really like that.
That's a really good point. So when I started off in my career, I said I was working for a guy who's my mentor. I worked for him for 7 years, and I was working my way up in marketing. And I thought, you know, maybe I could have his job. Maybe I could be a VP of marketing one of these days. And they said, we really want you to go out in the field. You're not going anywhere until you go out in the field and be a sales manager. And I was reluctant at first, but I loved that job. It was so much fun. I had 8 reps in the state of Michigan. A whole lot of freedom. And, you know, that was my second turnaround. Took him from last place to second place in 12 months. So it was a blast. So, I do think you made a great point. Be open to those changes and think about how they can really enhance your career. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I know you probably did some pretty good preparation on the question list that we sent you, and we haven't asked all of those questions. So what are the questions that we haven't asked you that we should have?
Yeah. What question?
So what questions on that list that we have not asked you do you think that we should have?
You've asked I think you've asked a lot of them. I think I kind of answered them. I don't know. One of the ones, what are you most proud of? What do you think is your greatest accomplishment? I talked a little bit about having so many people who reported to me who are now in leadership positions. But I think the most important thing is my family. I have a great family. It's a fun age to be where my daughters are in their 20s. They're working. Our oldest daughter is down in Savannah, is married, great guy, wonderful family. And she's doing something pretty cool down there. So we're excited for her. Our youngest daughter is in my old industry in diagnostics, and she's in sales, and she's living in Chicago, a block away from Wrigley Field. So she's living my total dream from my 20s. And, both girls are awesome. Her boyfriend is in the military and is in Italy for the next 3 years. So, and then my wife has been working for a company downtown Carmel here called Great Growings. They do plant walls and design. And then she's also working with another group, some friends of ours. They have an online interior design business called City and Ship Lab. So it's fun to see everybody doing something. You know, I think they're all engaged in things that they're passionate about. And I couldn't ask for more than that. So, yeah, at the end of the day, if your family's happy, that's a good place to be.
Yep. Yeah, there you go. Well, they've picked up, probably like you picked up a lot of things from your father. I'm sure they picked up a lot of things from you that's helped them out with where they're at today.
Some has helped them and some has hurt them. No, they're great.
So we just have a couple more what we call quick hitter questions.
Sure.
Before we wrap this up.
Yeah.
So if someone were visiting Indy, or maybe for you, it's better to say Carmel or the North Side, or a young professional were considering a job here, what things would you tell them to do to get a good feel for the city?
Well, I would tell them to go downtown, downtown Indy, and I'd tell them to walk around. You've got first-class amenities, basketball arena, football, convention center, baseball. You know, it's from that standpoint, it's terrific. Yeah, it's there's not many people down there today, but under normal circumstances, the place is just, you know, it's alive. So I think that's really cool. I think, you know, people don't tend to think of Indianapolis as having that kind of a vibrant downtown. It certainly has changed since we got here. I would tell them to spend some time in Broad Ripple. You know, Broad Ripple is a great place to go for somebody in their 20s or early 30s. And just, you know, spend a Saturday walking around. And then I would tell them to come up to Carmel and walk the Monon and see everything that's gone up on up here. Maybe take in we went over the other night, new places, the Goat Cafe. If you haven't been there yet, it's pretty cool. We like to go to Anthony's and sit and have a glass of wine, go to Peace Water, Sugar Creek. You know, there's so many great little restaurants and places. Friends of ours own Rosie's. So, you know, we get out and do all those kinds of things. And I think you get a real feel for what Carmel's about.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite app on your phone?
My favorite app. I do a lot of news and sports. Probably the one that gets used the most is probably Twitter. I shouldn't even say that. I think the newest thing that I've got, we've been using Monday.com and Slack, and I really find those to be really useful, fun tools to be engaged with. So those are the things that I do most. And I watch, you know, Cubs games on there and stuff like that. I've got my, you know, we stream and all that. So it's a lot of fun to do that. But yeah. Yep. Yeah. Weather. I'm always checking the weather. Love the weather app. AccuWeather. So
I think you probably just mentioned a handful of them, but what are your favorite places around Indy?
You know, we tend to stay more on the north side. I said Anthony's is a great place. I mentioned a couple others. And another great place for sushi is Chiba up in Westfield. Keith up there does a great job. So we go up and hang out there from time to time. I think those are kind of, if we're going downtown, we go to Prime 47 quite a bit. If we're going downtown, you know, probably something at the Conrad there. So we like hanging out there and in the restaurant, and going to football games and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. I noticed a theme here of restaurants. I think you guys might be foodies.
We are. We started dating in 1986 or 87. My wife was living in the city. She is pretty much fresh out of Miami of Ohio. And I was living in the suburbs, and when we were dating, we'd go down and go to dinner every night, you know, so there was something new. Chicago is great because you could step out on the curb and go, what do you want to do? And off you go. And when we first moved to Carmel, it's like, ooh, there's no place to go. Now there's a ton of places. And so it's a lot of fun. So yes, we're foodies. My wife is really great at making friends. She's everybody's best friend. She's a really lovely, wonderful person, and her friends love her. And so we have a lot with friends out to dinner places or, you know, Peace Water or something like that.
What would be your number one takeaway for a young professional listening to this?
If I were them, or what would I tell them is the number one takeaway?
Yep.
Be intentional about your career. And, beyond that is, you know, find somebody to mentor you. I would tell them, you know, get into something where they can and be coachable. So I think those are the three things. You know, I was intentional pretty early on in my career. I had mentors, but I didn't realize who they were, and I learned how to be coachable late. So I would tell you to do all those things. And I would tell you the last thing is really get engaged in the community. That was one thing Denny Ware taught us, is get engaged, be in the community. There's a lot of great things that you can do. I've been fortunate to be on a number of boards here in town. And, you know, I think it's a part of our responsibility to give back.
Yeah. Yeah. Where can listeners find out more about you or iTeam?
Well, the iTeam, we have a website, statusrex.com. We're working on a new one with our buddy Aaron, who's helping us. So we'll keep you posted on that. That'll be posted at some point. It'll be probably a new URL and totally different look and feel. Both Thaddeus and I are on LinkedIn. Thaddeus does a lot of work on Facebook. Me, not so much. Mostly sunsets and dog pictures and stuff like that. I keep it pretty, keep it pretty quiet on Facebook. So those are, I think, great places to find us. And, you know, and you'll always find us at the 4:30 meetup. And we're around.
Well, Dick, thanks for taking time out of your day and sharing your insights and experiences with us.
Well, yeah. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
This was our conversation with Dick Aderman. If you like this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you share it with your friends and rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. You can stay up to date by following Circle City Success on your favorite social media site. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in next Wednesday for our next episode with a new guest.